Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
On June 27th, 1995, 27-year-old Jody Huizentrud was late for work. This wasn't too shocking, as she anchored the morning news show for KIMT in Mason City, Iowa, and usually had to be at the studio by 3:30 a.m. Oversleeping wasn't uncommon, which is one of the reasons Jody lived so close to work. When her coworker Amy called Jody, she found that the anchor had, in fact, overslept, but was on her way. Except Jody never arrived. Hours went by and Amy knew something was wrong. Once police arrived at Jody's apartment complex, they saw a terrifying scene. Jody was gone, and it was clear that she didn't leave on her own. An investigation ensued, but despite media coverage and law enforcement efforts, Jody's case went cold. There have been many theories and leads over the years, but now, nearly 30 years after Jody Huizentrud's disappearance, could we finally be getting closer to the truth? When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Jody Huizentrud. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode, and he's here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. So Jody's case is actually a pretty well-known case in the true crime community. It's like one of the bigger ones that we've done, which, you know, I'm sure you still haven't.
Yeah, I was just going to say, unsurprisingly, I have not heard of this case.
Right. So, you know, I don't always like to do the big ones. But, you know, even though we're coming up on the 30-year anniversary of her disappearance, which will be the summer 2025, there have been leads and investigations and searches that have been going on fairly consistently throughout the past 30 years. And there has been new news in this case, like even just within the past month or so. So, you know, I figured it would be a good time to do it because I think that we're kind of getting to that weird point where something might actually happen here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So today, you know, we'll talk about it. We're going to kind of do, you know, like obviously it's one episode, so it's going to be a fairly brief overview of 30 years of an investigation.
Yeah. I mean, 30 years, not only is it a long time, but I mean, typically when we see cases go for this long, mm-hmm. it's usually because of lack of law enforcement involvement or doing things. So it's interesting that you said that this things have been developing over the past 30 years and there's still not answers. So
yeah.
I would imagine there's probably a lot of information out there.
Yeah, there is. And so we really kind of had to pare it down for this. But of course, you know, there are obviously, and we'll get into various resources, but there are definitely places where you can get kind of a lot more in-depth information. But yeah, you know, it's just, it's an interesting case. And like I said, I do think that something could be happening with it soon. So for those of you out there who maybe aren't familiar with it, this is a good way to kind of get up to speed in case you hear about it on the news sometime soon. Before we get started, we've had a couple of folks join us over on Patreon. So we want to give a shout out to Kara W. and Raven. Thank you so much for your support.
Thank you so much.
And remember, if you join us there on any level, starting at just $2 a month, you can get these episodes early and ad-free and also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. So now with all of that out of the way, let's get into the story of Jody Huizentrout. Jody Sue Huizentrout was born on June 5, 1968 in Long Prairie, Minnesota. She was the youngest daughter of Maurice and Jean Huizentrout and had two older sisters, Joanne and Jill. Jody's family experienced a huge loss when she was in her early teens when her father, Maurice, passed away from colon cancer in 1982.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah. So Jean ended up raising the girls on her own, but, and obviously, I mean, that's devastating.
Yeah.
But they were a very close family, and Jody grew up being athletic and smart and talented and very driven. Like, that's the one thing that I got from kind of researching her is that she was somebody who knew what she wanted and really worked to get it. She was so into just self-improvement, working on herself, and just doing whatever she needed to reach her goals. So in high school, she did well in school, but she was also a golfer. So she was on her school's golf team, and she, along with her team, went on to win the state Class A tournament in both 1985 and 1986.
Wow.
After graduation, Jody stayed close to home, enrolling in St. Cloud State University, which is only about an hour away from her home in Long Prairie. There, she continued to play golf and ended up graduating in 1990 with a double major in mass communications and speech communication.
I don't even know what you would do with those degrees.
Well, she did.
I would hope so, but...
Yeah, I mean, it could, because unlike many other people her age, Jody knew exactly what she wanted to be when she grew up. She wanted to be on television, and she was hoping that her degrees would get her there. Professor Gretchen Tippergein from St. Cloud State University spoke about Jody's ambitions, saying, quote, "It's sometimes frustrating when you have students who have aspirations that are way beyond their capabilities. Jody was one who had aspirations that were very realistic," end quote. While Jody's first job out of college was working for Northwest Airlines, she was soon able to make her move into broadcast journalism. Jody left Northwest for her position at KGAN-TV in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Now, it's not uncommon for journalists in local news to bounce around various stations, especially early in their careers, and Jody was no exception. In just a few short years, she went from KGAN to KSAX in Alexandria, Minnesota, before heading back to Iowa for a job at CBS affiliate KIMT in Mason City, where she anchored their morning show. Now, the morning show to viewers is a pleasant program to watch over coffee while you're getting ready for work or getting the kids off to school. But for those who work on it, it means basically waking up in the middle of the night and getting to work by 3:30, 4 a.m.
You might be familiar with that.
I know. Can you tell? I still have like, I haven't
PTSD
gotten over it.
Yeah,
right?
It? Yeah.
It's like, it's been 20 years since I've done that. But oh my God. No, but this one's even worse. So when I did used to work at a local news station, I was a production assistant. And I worked on the morning show, and I had to be to work at 4:30 because our show started at 7. Jody went on the air at 6.
Oh, my God.
So she was a full hour earlier than we were, which I can't even imagine. That was the schedule that Jody and KIMT producer Amy Kunz had. The pair worked closely together and would be up in the studio writing, editing, and doing their hair and makeup all before most of us were even awake. But on the morning of June 27th, 1995, Amy was alone at the station. Jody was nowhere to be seen. Now, this wasn't exactly abnormal. It was a brutal start time, and both women had been known to sleep through their alarms on occasion.
Understandable.
Yeah. So because of this, they had kind of worked out a plan if it happened. Both Amy and Jody lived close to the station, and whenever one of them missed their alarm and slept in, the other would give them a call to wake them up so that they could make like the 5 or so minute drive to the station and, you know, get there in time for the show. And other than a slightly rushed and stressful start to the day, these wake-up calls did the trick, and the morning news would make it onto air as scheduled. But on that particular morning, things would go very differently for both women. When Amy got to the studio and realized that Jody wasn't there, she gave her a quick call. And this is a little bit after 4 a.m. Jody answered and said that she had, in fact, slept through her alarm, but she was already up, she was awake, on her way, going to come to work. It wasn't a great start to the day, but, you know, Amy had her answer, and so she hung up and got to work while she waited for Jody to arrive. But Jody didn't show up. The hours slipped by, and Amy's focus shifted to getting the show on the air. After struggling to piece together the morning news on her own, Amy found herself without an anchor woman and with the clock ticking. Frustrated and stressed, she then threw herself into the chair and filmed the news herself.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's tough on many levels.
It is. Yeah, that's really hard. It was at 7 a.m. with the pressure of the morning rush behind her that the truly bizarre nature of the situation hit her. Jody only lived 5 minutes away, and Amy had spoken to her right after 4. So where was she? Why had it taken Jody 3 hours to still not show up for work? This was completely unlike her, but Amy still hoped that there was a possibility that Jody had simply fallen back to sleep and this had all been an honest and very annoying mistake. But in Amy's heart, she didn't believe that was true. She knew that Jody would never risk losing her dream job over an early morning start. So Amy called the police and asked them to perform a welfare check on her friend and colleague. The police went over to Jody's apartment complex, probably expecting to find an embarrassed Jody at home. But within seconds of their arrival, they knew that something was wrong and that Jody was in very real danger. Jody's car was still parked in the building's parking lot, but all of her things were strewn about around it. Her hairdryer, her jewelry, and her high heels lay on the ground, and beside them was a bent car key, almost like whoever had been holding it had been violently grabbed while trying to open the car door. It was immediately clear to police that Jody had been taken against her will, and now the clock was ticking. Everyone sprang into action, desperately trying to find one of the community's growing stars. Volunteers flooded the streets, handing out flyers and posters and spreading the news about Jody's kidnapping while the police continued to investigate the scene. A search of her home turned up nothing out of the ordinary. At her car, other than her belongings, they found only a palm print that received no hits from their databases. Several witnesses came forward, including neighbors who said that they had heard screaming during the early hours of the morning of the 27th. One of these neighbors would even report seeing a white van idling in the parking lot around the same time that they had heard the screaming, but frustratingly, none of them had thought to call it into police at the time. Another witness came forward with a harrowing tale that she later told FindJody.com. Wishing to remain anonymous, the woman told police at the time, and later, the website FindJody.com, of an experience that she had not too long before Jody's disappearance. So she was just a teenager at the time, and she lived in one of the apartment buildings that was adjacent to Jody's. So this was about a month before, and this 14-year-old girl was on her way home from school. She said, quote, "I went a bit down the path and heard a guy yell, 'Hey,' at me. I stopped running and looked to my right to see a man through a bit of trees leaning up against a building. He yelled at me again and then started running right toward me. I turned around and ran up a hill back up to Kentucky Avenue. I kept running to the next corner. My friend lived in the house near the corner. I ran up to their back door. It was unlocked and I ran inside. The guy had stopped chasing me once I got up to Kentucky, but I stayed inside and was looking out of the windows and eventually saw him walk past." End quote. The girl was terrified, and she told her mother about the experience and had even given a description of the man who had chased her. So she said that this guy was somewhere in his 20s to 30s and had long, shaggy, dark hair. But at the time, neither she or her mother reported this to the police. Once they heard about Jody's kidnapping and realized that she was their neighbor, that's when they came forward.
Now, did the police take it seriously, or were they dismissive because she was a 14-year-old girl?
See, that's the thing. We don't know.
Okay.
Because to this day, no one can say for certain that the police actually acted on that tip. And the only reason why I know about that now is, again, because she told the website, right, you know, 20-whatever years later.
Right. But the police didn't put that description out as a possible suspect or to gain any information from the public.
No, not to the public. Yeah. Okay. So we don't know if they investigated it on their own, if they dismissed it, what they did. But no, they did not put that out to the public. But it's a very interesting piece of information, not only because this happened right by where Jody lived, but because Jody may have had a stalker of her own. Did you know that your actual age might not be the same as your biological age? That's right. It's not just about your birth date. Your body could be older or younger than you think. Hey everyone, it's Kona, host of And Then They Were Gone, and I am coming to you today to talk about True Diagnostic. With their True Age test, you can discover your true biological age, plus get insights into things like your risk for heart disease, Alzheimer's, and even early mortality. And the best part? It's all done from the comfort of your own home. No prescriptions, no lab visits, just a simple test sent straight to your door. True Age is actually sending me a test, and I'm really excited to see what it's going to say about my health. And frankly, a little frightened. Because even though I'm afraid it's going to tell me that my biological age is higher than my normal age, it's definitely information that I can use. Because by tracking my biological age, I can actually see how changes that I make, whether exercise, diet, or sleep, can affect my health over time. And this isn't guesswork. The True Age test is based on peer-reviewed research from scientists working with Harvard, Duke, and Yale. I don't know. I like to know everything, so I think it's going to be really cool to know exactly how my lifestyle is impacting my body. I already know there's definitely room for improvement, and I think this is going to give me some actionable steps. So if you're ready to join me and find out your biological age, right now, my listeners can get 20% off their entire order at truediagnostic.com by using the code ATTWG at checkout. That's True Diagnostic, truediagnostic.com. Just use the code ATTWG to save 20%. Plus, if you subscribe, you'll get an additional 20% off the 50% discount. Discover your true age today. When Jody arrived in Mason City, she was practically an overnight success. She was optimistic, bubbly, and warm, and she made fast friends with all of her colleagues and the bigwigs at the station. But what was most vital to her career was the fact that the local community absolutely loved her. Everybody knew Jody. They knew of her. They knew what she looked like. People recognized her on the street and often stopped to ask her for photographs or autographs. It turns out that Jody was a big fish in a relatively small pond, but it was a pond that seemed full of mutual love and affection. At least it was that way until someone seemingly took things too far. About 18 months after Jody took the position in Mason City, she began to feel threatened by the consequences of her growing fame. Her hours at the studio often meant that she was up before dawn and out of the house in the middle of the night. And this would be enough to have most people, particularly women, on edge. But Jody had even more reason to be afraid than most. According to Jody, she had started receiving some nuisance calls, you know, hang-ups and weird just phone calls, things like that. She was even talking about changing her number. And one day when she was out for a run, she said she saw a black pickup truck following her. Jody's sister, Joanne Nath, later said, quote, "She got very, very nervous and was even crying when she called my mom on the phone. So after that, she was taking even more precautions," end quote. Jody enrolled in self-defense classes, but it wasn't enough to ease the growing sense of dread inside of her. So finally, she spoke to police. Frank Stearns from the Mason City Police Department told reporters, quote, "She thought she was being followed one morning on her way to work, and she made us aware of that right away. And we gave her escorts a few times after that. And no problems, no further problems," end quote. Or that was what everyone thought at the time. By June 26, 1995, the day before her disappearance, Jody had been dealing with this potential stalker for about 10 months. But she wasn't going to let it stop her from living her life. She went out that day and played in a golf tournament, and then went to visit a friend named John Van Sice. John was nearly 20 years older than Jody, but the two were very close. Or at least Jody meant a lot to him. John even named his boat after Jody.
This is giving me weird vibes.
Her birthday had been a few weeks prior. It was at the beginning of June. So that night, the 26th, he invited her over to his house to watch a videotape that he had put together of the surprise birthday party that he had thrown for her.
Okay. Are we thinking this is a potential suspect?
Well, yeah. I mean, he definitely made a few lists. And I'll get to it in a second, but he actually is the one who put himself on police's radar. So she went over the night before, she watched the video, and then went home. And when she was home, she called a friend. So they chatted for a while before Jody hung up, and, you know, we assume she went to bed. She had to be up at, you know, around 3 the following morning, but as Jody's colleagues would tell you, an early alarm would never hold her back. "You can sleep when you're dead," she was known to say to anyone who wanted to leave the fun early and get a good night's sleep, which is something I cannot identify with. Because when I worked that schedule, I was asleep at like 8 p.m. every night. She was obviously more fun than me. So, you know, like I said, she got home, called a friend, went to bed. So we know she was home. Everything was fine that night. We also know that she slept through her alarm the next morning.
Wait. This was the night before she went missing. She went over to this guy's house to watch a videotape that he had put together of the surprise party that he threw for her.
Yes.
Conversation with friend.
Yeah.
Do we know how that night with this guy ended? Like, did it end awkwardly?
I mean, not according to him, because he's the only one.
So the friend hasn't come forward saying, like, she said that it was weird. He professed his love to me or something.
No, no. I don't think it was anything like that. No, I don't think so. From what I read in one source, so I don't know how true this is, but it, like, I guess she called her friend, but her friend actually wasn't there. Her husband answered the phone. So she ended up just chatting with the husband for a little bit, maybe.
Okay.
But in any case, no, like, I don't think there was anything significant in that phone call at all. I think the main purpose of us knowing about the phone call is just to establish that she was at home.
Right.
And everything was fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, she got home, you know, talked on the phone, went to bed, slept through her alarm, talked to Amy the next morning.
Right. Yeah.
Said she slept through her alarm. So like, we know she was fine that night.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So we know that she made it home. We know that she was planning on going to work.
Yeah. The only reason why I'm asking those questions is because obviously, like, if this guy is like obsessed with her,
yeah,
even though they're quote unquote friends, whatever, if he had put this night together to try and like explain to her that he was in love with her and she was just like, you know, I'm not really interested in that. Now you're talking about like a scorned lover situation. They're friends. He probably knows where she lives, knows
the
time.
Well, no,
she
so that's
wakes
actually
up.
How they kind of got to know each other. So they apparently met at a bar, but he used to live in the same apartment complex where she lived. So they kind of like, you know, that's,
yeah, I mean,
they had
still,
that in
still
common.
Not off my radar though.
No. But I'm saying, so he definitely knew where she lived. Yeah. Like that was like one of the very first things they ever talked about.
Yeah.
Because he had gotten a divorce and then, you know, moved into this apartment. And I think he'd already moved out of the apartment complex by the time they met. He had a house. Uh-huh. But yeah, they're like, you know, just chit chatting. It's like, oh yeah, I used to live there, you know? So yeah, he absolutely knew where she lived. They were like close. They did a lot of stuff together. And some of her other friends said that she probably hung out with him more than like any other friend, really. But that there was nothing going on romantically.
According to her,
Well, yeah, no, yeah, according to her, because that was the thing. Like, so her other friends were like, so what is going on between you and John? And she's like, you know, nothing. Like, we're friends, whatever.
Right, but did John see it that way? Is what my point is.
Well, exactly, because a lot of people, including Jody's sister, thought that, yeah, he wanted something more.
Yeah.
But he always denied that. And, you know, we're skipping ahead a little bit here, but after she disappeared, when he was talking to reporters, he literally said to one of Jody's colleagues who was interviewing him right after her disappearance, he was like, no, she was like my daughter. She was like a child to me.
Okay. Does he own a white van?
No. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. So, okay, because we know that she got home and we know that, you know, Amy spoke with her and it was at 4:10 and she was ready to come to work, we know that she would have left her house shortly thereafter.
Right.
So the police were actually able to get a really narrow window of when this crime occurred.
Yeah.
You know, because based on all of her stuff in the parking lot, like, it's clear she made it out of her apartment.
Yeah. So you're looking at 4:15, 4:20.
Yeah. I would say anywhere between like 4:15, 4:30 is like probably, right. I think you have like a 15 minute window.
Yeah.
You know, we're not looking at a huge amount of time here.
Right.
And yes, it wasn't until after 7 a.m. that Amy called the police.
Right. But the timeline of disappearance.
Exactly.
Is shorter.
Very much shorter because, yeah. You know, Jody wasn't dilly-dallying for 2 hours.
Right.
After
she had to be
her.
At work.
Exactly. The yeah. show started at 6, you know?
Right.
So police, you know, did start to follow the stalker angle, thinking that Jody's abduction could be the work of a crazed fan.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And Jody's friend and fellow reporter, Tammy Baker, told the Up and Vanished podcast that she believes this mysterious stalker could absolutely be responsible for Jody's disappearance, saying, quote, I think some weirdo out there got an obsession with her and something bad happened, end quote.
And you said this occurred in the parking garage of her...
Parking lot. It's an outdoor lot.
Okay. Outdoor lot of her apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
Unsecured lot.
Yeah.
No cameras. It's just an open lot.
Yeah. It's just a parking lot. It's 1995. Like, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And, you know, it's 4 a.m, whatever. Nobody's yeah. out, really.
Right. But we have the eyewitness that says that they thought that they saw a white van idling.
Yeah.
In yeah. the parking lot.
And it was somebody driving by and he's like, I don't know. I thought it was a cop or something. Like, he kind of slowed down and looked, but didn't really see anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Tammy Baker, this reporter, is one of the friends who also talked about how she thought that John was into Jody and had asked Jody, like, what the deal was.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, but she also thinks that it could have been a crazed fan. And so, of course, investigators also interviewed people who are close to Jody, including John Van Cise. So I mentioned earlier, he actually put himself on police radar. So once news broke that Jody was missing, he went to police, like he showed up and was like, hey, I was the last person to see her alive.
Probably not the best thing to say,
yeah.
But sure.
So police are like, really? Tell me more.
Yeah.
So yeah, they obviously started looking at him like very closely. Yeah,
tell me more. Tell me how you know she's dead.
Yeah, right?
Like, why would you say that?
Yeah. They interviewed him at least 2 times. They gave him a polygraph. He did pass it. And, you know, he always was very unequivocal about having nothing to do with Jody's disappearance. As the days turned into weeks, the community, still alive with the drive to bring Jody home, made t-shirts, bumper stickers, and pins. They took to hanging ribbons in their front yards, all with the intention of keeping awareness of Jody's case alive and well. In September 1995, after 2 months with no solid leads or arrests, Jody's family hired a private investigator to try to bring their missing daughter home. These investigators then ended up reaching out to the public by using Jody's big passion, television. America's Most Wanted, Unsolved Mysteries, and even the new show Psychic Detectives all featured Jody and her case. In fact, Psychic Detectives, her kidnapping was the pilot episode of that show.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I've also never heard of that show.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. It was just another one of those random weird 90s shows. But despite this and the hundreds of tips that were generated by these episodes, it seemed that no one was getting any closer to actually solving Jody's case. About a year after she disappeared, volunteers took up arms yet again and scoured the streets. They informed the local police of any places of interest, but after investigation, the leads all came to a dead end. After 6 years and over 1,000 police interviews, Jody Huizentrout was officially declared deceased in 2001. But still desperate to find out what had happened to one of their own, journalists and retired police officers came together and created the website findjody.com. This site is the place to go for anything you would want to know about the investigation into Jody's disappearance. And like I said, I mean, we're obviously doing only one episode on this. There's so much more that's happened in the past 30 years. So you can go there and get all of the information that has been happening. And they've really, really done an amazing job of keeping her case active over the decades. And even though she went missing in 1995, one of the first big breaks in her case didn't come until 2008. In the summer of that year, the Globe Gazette received photocopies of Jody's journal. The sender was anonymous, but Mason City Police confirmed that the pages that the paper was sent did in fact come from Jody's journal, which is something that they had had in their custody since the initial search of her apartment back in 1995.
Okay, so the journal was in her apartment.
Yeah, and as soon as she went missing and police searched her apartment, they found the journal and they took it in as evidence.
Okay.
And it had stayed in the police station and then was suddenly mysteriously released to the paper, what, 13 years later?
Okay, so somebody that had access to their evidence room.
Well, not exactly the evidence room, as it would turn out. It actually came from the wife of former Mason City Police Chief Dave Ellingson. He had resigned from the position in 2006, and when he was cleaning out his office, he had apparently taken a copy of the journal home with him. And she found it, and she used to work for that newspaper, for the Globe Gazette, for like 20 years. And so she decided to send in these pages to the paper.
Why?
I don't know. We don't know why. We've never gotten any information.
I mean, there's a lot of whys there.
Like, a lot of whys,
why
right?
Did the chief of police make a photocopy of the journal?
And take it home.
Why did the wife, after discovering this, send it into the newspaper? Was it like to somehow make her husband a person of interest?
No, I don't think so, because he wasn't even the chief when she went missing. So okay,
so what was contained in those?
So I'll get to that. So Ellingson was not the chief in 1995. That was Jack Schleiper. Schleiper was forced to resign in 1997 and Ellingson replaced him. Ellingson then resigned in 2006.
Okay, do we know why the first chief was forced to resign?
Yeah, a lot of like political stuff, allegations of corruption, like it wasn't great. He then went to Wichita Falls, became police chief there, and was fired.
Okay.
So like that was a whole thing. Then Ellingson came and was chief for like 9 years, and then he resigned amid, you know, issues. I don't even know, like just kind of vague issues, like political stuff. So he resigned in 2006 and then his wife found this diary and sent it to the newspaper.
Okay. I feel like there's something there.
Right.
And maybe we won't ever find out the answers to that. But like, I don't understand why she would send the pages to the newspaper.
Well, no. And so the thing is that it kind of fed into one of the theories that had been growing over the years, is that there was some sort of police corruption and or cover up in Jody's case.
Okay.
And so like this whole thing made it seem even shadier. But the journal entries themselves,
yeah, That's what I want to know what's in the journal entries.
Yeah, it was nothing groundbreaking. It was nothing like, you know, oh, I'm working on this story uncovering corruption in the Mason City Police Department or anything like that, right?
Right.
Like, it was all self-improvement stuff. So she had apparently, like, I don't know if she had gone to a Tony Robbins seminar or read a Tony Robbins book or whatever, but, like, that's apparently why she started the journal, was it was a journey of self-improvement and manifestation and things like that. And so the pages that the paper released were just all about her talking about how she wanted to be a better person and get a better job and, like, the future that she wanted for herself.
Okay, so then I go back to why did the chief of police after the chief of police that was there when she went missing photocopy those pages and take them home? And we'll never get that answer.
No, we won't. But, and we haven't. It's just, it's such a bizarre thing.
Right.
But after this happened in 2008, a couple of years later, the chatter of
police involvement in her disappearance
just kind of grew. The abrupt resignations of two police chiefs raised suspicions on their own, but in 2011, a former Mason City police officer named names. A month after Mason City police officer Maria Ohl was fired from the force, she accused two fellow Mason City police officers and a member of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation of involvement in Jody's disappearance. She named Lieutenants Frank Stearns and Ron Vandy Weird of the MCPD and Bill Basler of the state DCI as co-conspirators.
Okay, interesting.
And Frank Stearns, I mentioned earlier in this episode, he's the one who gave the quote, who's like, oh yeah, she told us about the stalker and, you know, we escorted her a couple times or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, so he worked on her case.
Right.
So he was definitely involved in that regard. I'm not saying he's involved in her disappearance, but, like, he was actually there, right? Maria Ohl said, quote, I received information from multiple sources that a couple of our lieutenants were potentially involved in the murder and abduction of Jody Huizentrout. They are current, they have not been suspended, and have not been terminated, end quote.
So this is the first instance of actually saying murder also.
Yeah.
So she is claiming that she has evidence or somebody came to her.
Yeah, somebody came to her. An anonymous source came to her.
And said that these two lieutenants were involved in not only an abduction or the abduction of Jody, but a murder.
Yeah, and this is 2011, and Jody was declared legally dead in 2001. So the police were treating this as an abduction and murder.
Sure.
Yeah.
But now you have somebody that's actually saying it.
Yeah, and naming names.
Right.
But nothing really seemed to go from there.
So we don't know if some other agency investigated this. She put this out to the newspaper and she named names.
Yeah.
And we don't know.
No, and it's difficult to know how much stock to put in these accusations. So Ohl went on to sue MCPD for wrongful termination and discrimination. And she settled out of court for $95,000. So it could be a viable lead. There could be something going on here, but it could be a complete red herring as well.
Right.
What I will say is over the years, and this is something that we know to be true, investigators have not stopped looking into John Van Cise. He was never cleared, even though, you know, police did confirm he did pass that polygraph, but that was not enough for them. In 2017, Mason City Police issued two warrants for Van Cise's vehicles along with a GPS warrant. Now, he had moved to Arizona a couple years after Jody's disappearance and eventually remarried, but apparently periodically visited the Mason City area. Now, the vehicles the warrants were for were both manufactured after Jody's disappearance. So these vehicles did not, you know, were not directly involved in anything. We can know that for certain.
Yeah, it wasn't a white van.
No, none was a white van. One was like a 1999, one was like a 2013 or, you know, something like that. I forget the years, but they were not in existence when Jody went missing.
I'm just curious as to what they thought that they would find and what probable cause did they have to get those warrants.
Well, that would be interesting to know, but we won't know because those warrants have been sealed. So we don't know the content of them, but there was a GPS warrant, and it's been speculated that basically they were hoping that when he went back to Mason City, that he would return to the scene of the crime or return to wherever he put Jody. And that was kind of what they were trying to get to.
Yeah, sure.
But in terms of, the reasonable suspicion or anything like that, the warrants have been sealed. So there's just no information there. Now, in 2019, so 2 years after this, a new PI got involved in Jody's case. Steve Ridge is working on the case pro bono and has since represented Jody and her family's interest in bringing her home. And he was even able to get John Van Cise to agree to an interview at his home in Arizona that same year in 2019. And Van Cise reiterated that he had nothing to do with Jody's disappearance, and also shared that he had recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. So the chances of getting any new information from him one way or the other were quickly disappearing.
Yeah.
Steve Ridge worked diligently on the case and began to run down leads. In November 2024, in an interview with News Nation, he talked about some new information in the case that had not been publicly known before. He said that he believes that a new boyfriend that Jody had been seeing for about 10 days before her abduction could have been what led to her killer suddenly springing into action. What he says is very interesting, so I want to play the clip for you so you can hear it directly from him. And again, like, this was all new information in November of 2024, so this is very, very recent. So that's why I just kind of want to play it.
Well, that's probably the single most important thing that I've uncovered, frankly. And it was known to this gentleman was known to police, but wasn't even known to some of her closest friends, which is very interesting. She met this gentleman on a Saturday night in a bar, would be two Saturdays before she went missing. They were together no less than five times in person that final 10 days. They had dinner, they played golf, they had drinks out on his patio. They had daily phone contact. I mean, it was a whirlwind relationship. And I can tell you that that was witnessed. The beginning of that relationship was witnessed by someone. And this is part of why I believe that basically jealousy is the reason for Jody's abduction. I'm not necessarily saying that the individual went there with the intent of abducting her, but he certainly went there with the intent of confronting her. Things may have quickly escalated out of control. And, you know, whether it was accidental or not, I think that she ended up deceased very quickly.
Okay, so that's all the information he's willing to give.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I will say that this part of the interview came right after Steve said that he had narrowed it down to about four suspects. He said he had four people on his list still, and that he could not rule John Van Cise out.
Uh-huh.
He also said that he believes that more than one person was either involved or has knowledge about where Jody was disposed of.
Okay.
And he said that he had received information about specific weights that were used to dump her body in a lake, and that those weights may have put her down into the deepest part of that body of water.
Okay. Wow. It's a lot to uncover there, or a lot to unpack there.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we don't know what sources he has for this information.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is true, or if we are to believe that it's true, that puts John Van Cise back as number one suspect to me, because it's, again, it's an odd relationship. Yes, I understand that age difference doesn't automatically mean it's an odd relationship, but it seems, you know, come over to my house and watch this videotape that I made surprise birthday party. And then all of her friends are saying that they thought that they had an odd relationship.
Yeah. And also, so I had read about this birthday party and, you know, what I had read was like, oh, he co-hosted it with some other friends, right?
Okay.
Like they threw her birthday party. I'm like, okay, well, that's a normal, like weird, not weird thing, right?
Yeah.
Then I saw a picture of like the invitation and at the bottom of it, it said hosted by John Van Zeiss and friends.
Yeah.
Like he put his name on it.
Yeah. I still think that there's something there. Again, the whole like, come over to my house. I spliced this video together of mm-hmm. your surprise birthday party that I threw for you. Like all of it to me is in my mind leading to, you know, the same thing. Like it's, he was basically bringing her over to his place to profess his love to her.
Yeah, and I don't know if he necessarily did that night or whatever, but he could have.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting because when I mentioned the Up and Vanished podcast, they actually did like a show on Oxygen about this case. And somebody, and law enforcement has said they do not know who did this. Somebody actually leaked the videotape of the birthday party to Up and Vanished. And they aired part of it on the Oxygen show. And Jim Clemente, who's a retired FBI profiler.
I actually know who he is.
He knew something.
Yeah.
He watched it and he was like, yeah, if you watch John during that, anytime Jody's like talking to another guy, dancing with another guy, he looks pissed, basically.
Yeah.
Like he does not look happy.
Yeah. So, okay.
And so then you take that going into what the PI is saying about jealousy.
Yeah. And there's a potential new boyfriend.
Right.
Or and that's not even a boyfriend.
No, not even just some dude she was hanging out with like for 10 days.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. A total of five times.
A total of five times.
Which is like, you know, potentially the budding of a relationship or whatever. Yeah. But like,
they weren't getting married.
I could have gone nowhere.
Right.
Who knows?
Right.
Could have just been the beginning of something that ended quickly. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, you put those together. It's
right. And what Steve is saying, what Steve Urge is saying there is that was triggering.
Yeah.
For the person who did this. And this person was there and saw kind of the beginning of this relationship, this whatever it is.
Right.
And it was bothersome.
Yeah.
And I think if you do go back to your theory of like maybe something did happen at John Van Zeiss's house that night and maybe he couldn't get it out of his head.
Right.
And he went to Jody's house. He knew her schedule, obviously. He knew where she lived. Like he knew that she'd be up and leaving her house at, you know, I'm sure he figured 3:30 when she was supposed to leave. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense that somebody who knew her schedule, who knew she was going to be there and who was maybe like thinking about something, couldn't get it out of his head, went there to talk to her, went there to do whatever.
Yeah.
Not doing anything, not thinking like, oh, I'm going to do something violent.
Right.
But you know? Then
could have escalated.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing, though, is the bent key.
Well, no, but to me, she had her key in the door,
right,
and was grabbed.
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
that's not I want to talk.
Well,
and
no, but
then
it could escalate. Okay, but think about it.
To me, it's key is in the door. I'm facing the door, ready to go to work. My bag is full of my personal belongings, including a hair dryer, which I also think is weird. But
I don't think that's weird at all. Okay. Again, that's normal, like news, morning news stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
Then I get grabbed. That's how the key gets bent.
Yeah. So I think that points to like, yes, like kind of more of a stranger abduction. But what if it's this? What if it's somebody you know, whether it's John or somebody else, right? What if it's somebody you know, somebody who's talking and you're already running late for work, first of all.
Uh-huh.
You definitely don't have time for whatever this nonsense is. You're tired. You're probably irritated. You're stressed. And you go, you know what? I can't do this right now. I can't talk about this.
Yeah.
Call me later. We'll talk about it later. I'm leaving, put your key in the door, and then that's when the person's like, no.
The only thing is that the key being bent, to me, signifies some sort of forceful impact or grab either with speed or some force from a certain direction. So right. It's not necessarily, to me, it doesn't seem like they're having a face-to-face conversation.
Well, no, I think they were.
And
yeah.
Then,
yeah. I could see that though.
I can't see the key. Like,
I could see that. Like, she's putting the key in the door and, you know, turns her back on him, basically puts the key in the door, and then he gets mad and just basically like rushes her.
Yeah, but if they're that close having a conversation, I don't. My point
he's a big dude. And you haven't seen him.
No, I haven't.
But he's a big guy. And I just, and she was like small. She's like 5'3", 5'4", you know, 110, 120 pounds. She's small. He's a big guy. And I just think that, yeah, like maybe he just came up beside her. Like, I don't think he would need to be that far. I think he could have been close and still have done that potentially.
I guess
it's him or, you know, another big guy. I'm not saying I don't know.
Yeah.
It could have just been another big dude.
I also don't know. You know, you say a bent car key. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's bent at a 90 degree angle.
Oh, no,
it's
not.
It could have just been bent slightly.
It's slightly
so
bent.
I don't know.
It is slightly bent. I will say that. I did see a picture of the car key.
Because when you say bent to me, it's just, you know, it's like, no. I think of like a big impact from the side.
No.
Jarring her to the side and it bending like that or whatever.
No, it's
where
not
was,
that
also
bent.
Where was the car key found? Was it found
in the parking
in
lot?
In the door?
No, it was out on in the parking
okay.
lot.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe you're right.
Yeah. I don't know, but it is interesting. And
I mean, this is the most plausible explanation if what the PI found
is true.
We don't know the sources. We don't know any of the background behind this. We don't know where he got the information about the weights for the body. Like, where the hell did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, you know, an anonymous source, but yes.
Okay, well, yeah. I mean, this is how many years later, the anonymous source, like, that could be an internet conspiracy theorist.
No, it sounds like it's, look, so from what he was kind of saying in the interview, it does sound like, you know, he had that list of four.
Well, who were the other three?
Well, he's not saying.
I mean.
No, but he says that like he thinks that people know things, but they're not coming forward because they would implicate themselves.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So it sounds like potentially he talked to somebody who may have either been involved or may know something and doesn't want to implicate themselves. You know, it could all be bullshit. Like we don't know, but it is interesting. And like I said, this is all going on, you know, in the last couple months. And there have been new searches in her case in the last couple months as well.
Bodies of water, perhaps?
No, there have been bodies of water that have been searched. There was search of a home, like of land in Minnesota, I believe, but none of it turned up anything. So the point is that there are a lot of leads that are actively being looked at basically as we speak. But in terms of John Van Cise and answers that he could potentially provide, I mentioned back in 2019, he told Steve Ridge that he had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. By the time Steve Ridge gave this interview to News Nation in November 2024, he said that Van Cise's Alzheimer's had progressed to the point where he was incapacitated. And again, he said it's interesting. I just really recommend everybody watch this interview, the entire interview, because it's interesting the way he like doesn't name names and kind of says things at different times that still kind of relate to each other. Mm-hmm. He does say at one point, he's like, well, I think that we could resolve this case. I don't think we could solve it necessarily because I don't think we could prosecute anybody for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So I think it's kind of, if you read between the lines, you can kind of get where he's going there.
Yeah. Based on his theories and information he has. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it would have been possible in November when he gave that interview for John Van Cise to say something or aid in his own defense, if he were to be arrested, it's too late now because on December 6th, 2024, he did pass away. So if he was involved, any answers that he had likely died with him. But that doesn't mean that all of the answers are gone. Steve Ridge does seem to have some good leads. And now that John is gone, it might actually compel others to talk. You know, so if there are people who weren't necessarily staying quiet because they didn't want to implicate themselves, but because they were protecting him.
Right.
Maybe now they will talk, or even if it's not him, and I'm not saying that it is. I have no idea. Mm-hmm. But if there's anybody out there who's maybe protecting somebody, you know, people do die. And maybe with enough time, as we often see with these cold cases, there might be a change of heart and somebody might see something. We may be coming up on the 30th anniversary of the case this summer, but it is far from unsolvable. Jody's mother, Jane, passed away in 2014, but her sisters are still out there fighting for justice. Speaking at one of the anniversaries for Jody's disappearance, her family released a statement. In it, they said, quote, "We never thought a tragedy like this would happen to our family. Please do not make us wait another year for answers. We implore you. If you know something, say something. The pain of not knowing where Jody is or what happened to her is a pain we could never wish on anyone. Please help us bring Jody home." End quote. Jody Huizentrout has been missing from Mason City, Iowa since June 27, 1995. She's abducted from her apartment complex. She's a white female with blonde hair and brown eyes. At the time of her disappearance, she was between 5'3 and 5'4 and weighed 110 to 120 pounds. Jody was 27 when she went missing. She would be 56 today. Anyone with information regarding Jody Huizentrout's disappearance is urged to call the Mason City Police Department at 515-421-3636. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher, with additional research by Nikki Elmas. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!